Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Donald Worster, professor of history at the University of Kansas, and we're discussing his award-winning book, River Running West. Donald, glad to have you back on the show.
Well, hello, Hugh. It's good to be back and talking to you.
The subtitle of River Running West is called The Life of John Wesley Powell. It's a biography, a fairly long biography, but absolutely fascinating read by my lights. Wonder if you can begin, though, by giving the listener a sense of what's so special about John Wesley Powell that would lead you to write a biography about him.
Well, he's certainly not a household name in many parts of the United States today. Although, if you go out to the Colorado River, you'll see his name on Park Service placards everywhere. He's special because he is associated with the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon and exploration of the whole Colorado Plateau. He's also special if you go to Washington, D.C., because his name is all over parts of Washington. Out in Reston, Virginia, the U.S. Geological Survey's core headquarters building is the Powell Building. So he is a man who both is identified with the West of the late 19th century and with Washington, D.C., and government science. So he's a person who I think needs to be better known and understood than he has been by people living across the breadth of the country.
Later in the show, I want to go back and look at more detail about the exploration of the Colorado Plateau, as you described it, in his life in Washington. I think, though, it would be helpful to give the listener at least a snapshot of his early life, in particular those aspects of his early life that you think were especially important in shaping the kind of adult that John Wesley Powell was to become.
Sure. Well, he was born in Upper New York State to British immigrant parents of Methodist evangelical faith. They'd come to the United States to proselytize and also to improve their economic situation. They moved around a great deal. He grew up in parts of Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin. So before this was all before the Civil War. He was born in the 1830s and found an education in very small colleges, never getting a college degree, but small colleges throughout the Midwest, including Oberlin, Illinois College, what is now Wheaton College. So he was part of that period before the Civil War, incredible ferment of the United States, growing up with parents who were strongly religious. On the other hand, he was buffeted by the rise of science, exploration, eventually Darwin and Darwinism. So his life in his early years was really caught between these poles of evangelical religion and natural science. Eventually, he became a soldier in the Civil War, a major, rose to the rank of major, where he was severely wounded at the Battle of Shiloh. So he was in on that important event, both to save the Union and also because of his opposition to slavery.
Okay. I think that gives a snapshot of his early life. What I want to do now is to focus on the two major aspects of his life that you talked about. One is his role as an explorer, and then later in the show, his role as not just a bureaucrat, but at least in part a bureaucrat and an intellectual leader in Washington and throughout the country. On the first, could you give an overview of what was so significant, what was so important about Powell's exploration, and perhaps, again, at least a sense of the sorts of exploration that he did undertake?
Well, I suppose every one of your listeners has heard of Lewis and Clark, who sort of opened the 19th century with the exploration of the West, going up the Missouri River, down the Columbia. Powell basically ends that whole period of 19th century exploration. He went into the last unmapped, uncharted part of the American West, which was the Colorado Plateau, southern Utah, northern Arizona, the area that surrounds the Grand Canyon. People had been in and around it, and certainly the Native Americans knew it pretty well. But it was still unmapped, or at least on the maps of the West, it was a blank spot. And in the late 1860s and early 1870s, Powell filled in the details. And his party then went on to explore that whole country very systematically, to map its topography, the lay of the land, And of course, it is one of the most incredible landscapes on the face of the earth. I mean, tourists all over the world are coming now to see this place. Powell was there first and interpreted for Americans and tried to understand that place, which was so radically different from anything Americans had seen or experienced elsewhere.
Okay, so he was the first white man, or at least the first white man, to intentionally lead an expedition down the Colorado.
Intentionally is an important word.
Right.
It's likely that somebody else, a man by the name of James White, went down at least part of the river through the canyon, but totally without intention. I mean, he was fleeing hostile Indians and jumped into the river with a couple of logs and hung on for dear life. It's still controversial where he went, but he didn't remember much of what he had seen. Powell was the first to come down the river. This was in the summer of 1869. He lost most of his notes, and his maps didn't come back in very good shape. In fact, not at all. They were lost, but that was the foundation for going back again and again. He came back for a second expedition in 1871-72, two-year expedition, and he really understood what he was seeing. He understood the forces that had made the Grand Canyon, the geological forces, and began to interpret it for the first time.
Okay, and the exploration really began quite a ways up into Utah with the Green River, correct? And then eventually into what we now know as the Colorado.
Yes, actually in Wyoming, southwestern Wyoming.
Oh, okay, it was never quite clear to me exactly where he began. I saw the Green River did go up into Wyoming, but I wasn't sure where he began his trip.
The Green River comes out of the Wind River Range in western Wyoming. And into Utah, as you say, and joins the Grand River to form the Colorado near Moab, Utah. He put in May 1869 on the Green River in the extreme southwestern corner of Wyoming. The reason they put in there was because the new Transcontinental Railroad, the first railroad across the United States, had just finished building its tracks and railroad bridges across that country few months earlier. So he was able to ship his wooden boats out from Chicago and unload them from railroad cars into this wild river and set off there, rather than trying to come up the Colorado River from, well, Yuma, Arizona, or someplace farther south.
How long was this trip?
It was approximately 3 months, and it was expected to be much longer than it was, but they lost many of their supplies within the first week or so. They had to cut the trip short. It was not, in that sense, very well planned, or at least they had a crisis they had to deal with. He was planning to be gone for a year, but they finished up in late August of 1869.
Now, one of the things which you just briefly alluded to earlier was that this was the first white expedition, the expedition by white men, that Native American Indians clearly had some experience in these areas. I mean, in fact, in the book, you talk about that he would get into places where he assumed no one had ever been before, and he would suddenly see signs that Indians, in fact, had been there. I take it, though, part of what happened throughout the trip was that he gained a certain kind of understanding of interest in and appreciation for Native American Indians that was perhaps unusual at that time. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yes, well, it probably starts a little earlier, mostly in western Colorado in the preceding winter when he was living among the Utes in western Colorado. But Powell went on to develop from that an interest in all of the Native peoples of the Great Basin. The Utes, the Paiutes, are the main peoples in that country, and they had not been well studied. In fact, of course, the study of Native Americans in the 1860s, 1870s was still pretty much a beginning rather than a well-developed field. There really wasn't anything called anthropology, for example, in American universities at that point. So in a sense, Powell was a kind of proto-anthropologist and a student of Native Americans, particularly fascinated by their languages, the variety of their languages, and what those languages might suggest about their philosophy, their view of the world. That really intrigued him a lot. So we went back many, many times, and over the decade of the 1870s, he spent time with many different tribal groups, but also with the Navajo and the Hopi over in Arizona. Went into the Hopi villages, observed their ceremonies, wrote about all of these different experiences, and eventually went on to found the Bureau of Ethnology in the federal government, in the Smithsonian, which was really a pioneering institution for the scientific study of Native Americans. So in all that sense, Powell was taking Indians seriously. I mean, he believed these were extraordinary people. He'd been taught by his Methodist parents that, you know, all men are created equal, the brotherhood of man. And so he had no deep racial hostilities or feelings of their inferiority. He did, however, represent the views of his time in believing that Native Americans were culturally doomed. They had to give way to a superior civilization, the white man's European civilization, technology, and particularly science. He believed Native Americans had to adjust and become integrated into American society. I mean, he was an integrationist. He was not an exterminator. But basically, integrating people on the foundations of the whites and not of the Indians.
I may come back and talk a little bit more about that later. The other aspect, in fact, you already hinted in that in giving that answer. The other aspect of his life is very important, was his role as in government service and in developing certain scientific groups in the United States in his period after he returned from these explorations. I wonder if you could just briefly pick out what you see as the most important elements of those years.
Well, in the 1870s, after his exploration of the Colorado, he went to Washington, basically settled there, moved there with his wife and child, and tried to find essentially a scientific career within the context of Washington, D.C. That's a period when Washington is still a pretty small town and not very well formed. Certainly, the government support for science was very, very minimal at best. Powell got in on all that and really became one of the most important early figures in government science, that is, science supported by the federal government. And he did that through becoming the director, the second director of the U.S. Geological Survey. Today, that organization does a lot with minerals and water policy and sometimes even climate, all of those geological and earth sciences. In his day, it was a new organization. He was a critical figure in supporting it, and what he did was to try to funnel federal dollars into the sciences, to understand the American landscape and to map it, to create maps for people that they could see and understand this land that they had conquered, acquired. Powell was really the founder of our topographical maps that you can buy from the U.S. Geological Survey still today. So you might say he was a kind of pioneer figure in what became the National Science Foundation and other organizations in Washington that pour billions and billions of dollars today into both pure and applied science.
I want to explore those issues in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Donald Worster, professor of history at the University of Kansas, and we're discussing River Running West, the life of John Wesley Powell. You said that he played this very important role in science, and in fact, you mentioned that he established the Ethnology Institute at the Smithsonian, that he was the first director, or second director, first sustained director, I suppose, of the U.S. Geological Survey. Helped form the Anthropological Society and the National Geographic Society, clearly had a very important role in setting a certain sort of scientific agenda, if you will, for the federal government. Why was he so taken with science, and why did he think the federal government ought to be funding it?
Well, I think he believed that this was a culture based on science. Civilization needed to be based on science. That science provided good, fair, objective answers to the fundamental questions, how we're to live, and a government policy ought to be based on science, scientific research. For him particularly, the big issue was, how do you occupy the American West? How do you settle it? Do you just let this happen in a laissez-faire way, or do you try to plan it? Do you try to come up with scientific evidence about what kind of place it is, and do you let that evidence guide policy? Well, he was emphatically in favor of the second. I mean, he really wanted to see these policies founded on science rather than upon superstition or folklore or just some hit-or-miss ignorance. Why did he want to do this? Well, I think he had an enormous faith that science was beneficial to human beings. It gave them a more secure place on the earth, that it worked to everybody's benefit and not just for the benefit of the few. But it was a kind of salvation for people in a way that religion had been for his parents. So, I mean, he was an enormous believer in the promise of science as a guide to life in general, but particularly in terms of living on the land. I should say also that, you know, I think of Powell as one of the great founders of the conservation movement in the United States. And this is a role that he's often not been associated with, but and it's not the conservation that everybody thinks of today, but it certainly, for his day, was important to get knowledge through maps and geological information about land, water, soils, plants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and get those into the hands of people so that when they came to live on a place and try to make a living there, they had something more to go on than simply ignorance.
In fact, you mentioned water, and that seems to me to be a very good example of the reason he was concerned about science, that there were some people in the early days, perhaps the West, who had this vision that one day the West would be just as populated as the rest of the country, that there would be all these small farms from one end of the West to the other. And part of what Powell wanted to say was, wait a moment, hold it. That just isn't going to be possible because the land, the West, the interior West, is just too arid. There's not enough rain to sustain the substantial agriculture in the way that you might in the Midwest or the East. And so you had to rethink how you're going to develop the West.
Exactly. There are a lot of people around who understood that the West was a lot drier than the East. I mean, it didn't take too long in a covered wagon going out across Nebraska in August or across the Nevada through the Humboldt Sink area to understand that. But still, the country was in the grip of this kind of Jeffersonian ideal of turning the whole continent into small productive farms, virtuous farms, and very few people had been west to see what it was like out there, including a lot of congressmen who continued to believe that, you know, anything was possible in America. It was always, I mean, all the pictures we see of the 19th century West are rosy. There's always a golden glow, you know, in the distant horizon. People are always pointing with their finger off towards this golden glow out there, the land of plenty, the land of abundance, the garden of the world. And Powell came along and said, wait a minute, people. It's a lot worse than you think it is out there. I mean, it's a beautiful country, but abundance is not the reality for most of it. It is a land of scarcity, deep scarcity, in the most vital resource, water. And how are you going to farm it without having kind of water that you had in Virginia or even in Illinois, Tennessee? I mean, you're going to be up against desert conditions, and there were a lot of people who didn't want to accept that. It just seemed to be, you know, God didn't design America to have a desert. It just didn't seem right somehow in the minds of a lot of people. Or if there was a problem, well, people would figure it out. We didn't need to spend a lot of money on science. People would go out, they would suffer, they'd learn, many would fail, but that's the way America works. So he was up against a lot of mythology. He was up against the general feeling that people ought to take their chances and, you know, fail if they had to. And he didn't see this was a particularly good way to go about dealing with what he regarded as environmental realities. But there was a world of limits out there, and this is an idea we talk about a lot today. It was not an idea that people talked about a lot in the 19th century. But Powell was a prophet of limits, a sense of scarcity and of limits that would put real constraints on what people could do, that they needed to be realistic about the land. Not that they shouldn't not go out there, they shouldn't try to farm, but they should be realistic about it and have a sense of the limits, learn what those limits are.
Or to put it differently, then, what he wanted to do is he wanted us to plan. He didn't want us just to go. He wanted us to know what we were facing before they got there and how a person might profitably live upon the land.
He certainly wanted them to go armed with as much knowledge as we could provide them. And that was the function of the geological survey in his mind. It wasn't simply to go out and get information about where minerals were in the ground to help mining companies. It was to help the common folk understand and navigate this landscape.
In what ways did Powell help shape or influence policy toward Native American Indians?
Well, I think his main contribution was on the intellectual level, that is, understanding them as cultures, trying to fit them into some sort of comparative framework with European society, understanding their languages and material culture, all of that. As far as government policies are concerned, he tried to support the development of reservations for Native Americans, ample reservations that would give them a land base and allow them time to adjust to the coming of white civilization. He also supported, however, the idea of turning Indians into farmers as quickly as it could be done. He knew it would not be an easy process, but he believed that they had to give up a hunting and gathering life. The game would be gone. This was going to be an agricultural civilization, cattle or crops of some sort in the West, and they had to become farmers along with the whites and do so as quickly as possible. And that meant basically turning them not only into farmers but into homesteaders, you know, on their 160 acres or whatever the land base would have been. For Powell, it wouldn't have been 160 acres exactly. So he supported the what is now the infamous Dawes Act, that basically, having created reservations, then began to break them up into smaller parcels. Or at least he was. It's hard to find much evidence he actually went out and supported that particular law at that time. But he supported the idea that eventually these reservations would have to become private property. Indians would have to join the white man in a world of private property and not community property. So those policy ideas he basically supported, and of course today they've come in with a lot of criticism from historians who find them insensitive, wrong-headed, anti-Indian, a new kind of cultural imperialism, ethnocentric, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Powell was not advocating what many people in the 20th century have indicated have been advocating for Native Americans, which was complete and total self-determination, et cetera. He really, as I said earlier, believed they had to be basically forced into a private property, commercial, agricultural world.
Okay, in the last 4 minutes, I wonder if you would try to give the listener your sort of overall summation of perhaps Powell's strengths and greatest achievements and maybe even his weaknesses, things he did not achieve or perhaps character flaws that may have led him not to achieve some of the things he wanted to achieve.
Well, he remains a kind of enigmatic person, I have to say. Almost all of his correspondence was burned after his death by one of his associates, probably because he got himself into so many conflicts and probably said a lot of things that he shouldn't have said about powerful people in Washington. In fact, he was drummed out of office eventually by powerful senators. And Powell has to bear some responsibility for that. All of his life, he was a man of incredible driving energy. I mean, just incredible energy. Raging up and down the rivers, climbing the Grand Canyon walls, a man driven to succeed, and he stepped on people here and there. He made a lot of people angry because he seemed to be insensitive to their needs, or he didn't give them enough credit, or he was unfocused. He was doing this today and doing something else tomorrow. People couldn't keep up with him. They didn't know, you know, really what he stood for. So there were a lot of flaws in this man, a man of enormous vision and ambition and energy, who at the same time could be quite abrasive, even sometimes arrogant towards other people, dismissive of their ideas. The people he worked immediately with generally revered him. They thought he was a man of incredible generosity. But not everybody around him liked John Wesley Powell. He was a key figure in Washington and founding organizations. He gave enormous amounts of time in the evenings, to various kinds of institutions, literary and scientific institutions, clubs, to try to create a cultural life for Washington, D.C. He made wonderful contacts, and you know, he had all kinds of honors come his way during his lifetime, including honorary degrees from Harvard and so on. But nonetheless, always a controversial man who spoke his mind and riled a lot of people and said things to U.S. senators that some of them just didn't want to hear. So he's a hard man to sum up. I suppose a man with a much more humble and quiet demeanor would never have done what he did in the first place. I mean, even to undertake to navigate and explore the Colorado River with no funds except what he could cobble together here and there was an incredible venture. All his crew, you know, had trouble with him. But on the other hand, what other person of his age did that? I mean, who achieved what he did through this driving force of his personality?
In 30 seconds, if he could identify, do you think if he had to identify the most important thing he ever did, what do you think it would be?
Oh, I think the thing that really always captured his imagination the most was his work on Native Americans. And, I mean, I think he really saw that as his primary scholarly contribution, the study of Native American languages, their geography. We've come to, I think, revere him more for his work in exploration, and, of course, for his early conservation policies, his topographic maps and so on. But in his own mind, it was the science of man, of humanity and of culture and civilization that he was in the process of creating. That would be the foundation for policies and government legislation and a new civilization. So I think it was that more than anything else. I think he was wrong. That stuff kind of ended up, you know, on the cutting floor in the 20th century, whereas it's this other, his work on the West and water and watersheds and all the rest of it has become of lasting relevance.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Been speaking today with Donald Worster, professor of history at the University of Kansas. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.